Welcome to London Lopate at Large. I'm London Lopate. Jim Leahy is one of the most famous bakers in America. His Sullivan Street Bakery delivers bread to over 300 restaurants in New York, and he is the author of two best-selling cookbooks, My Bread and the Sullivan Street Bakery Cookbook. The James Beard Foundation named him the first recipient of its Outstanding Baker Award, and 2 years ago, they inducted him into their Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America. It is my great pleasure now to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Well, thank you, Leonard. It's nice to be here.
The New York Times reports that your recipe for no-knead bread is one of the most popular it's ever published. That has to be gratifying.
Yeah, it really is. It's kind of morphed into a life of its own, and so many people have adopted it as theirs, which kind of was the intent, that people would embrace it and then kind of riff on it. And I think there's like 9 or 10, last count, authors of no-knead books. I don't think any of them attribute me.
Well, some of them say they got it from their grandmother.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine too. I mean, it just, but it's cool. I mean, it definitely had a reverse logic on my part in terms of figuring it out. I'm really glad that everyone's embracing it.
Mark Bittman says that he only knew you by reputation when he received an email from you 12 years ago saying, I have a new method of making bread and that requires no kneading and can give you professional results at home. Now, he said he was intrigued by that, but you'd been in the bakery business for a while by that time, since 1994.
Yeah, well, I started baking professionally around 91, 92.
What got you into it? What had you done before?
I'm a visual artist. I was doing visual arts and performing art, performance art, not performing arts. I had been kicked out of School of Visual Arts at one point, and then I went to Stony Brook University to get a real education, learn about history, science, philosophy, all these things.
How do you get kicked out of the School of Visual Arts? I would think that's one of the most tolerant schools in the world.
It's a long story.
Okay.
But basically...
I didn't mean to embarrass you.
No. But basically, there was a professor named Paul Waldman who was married to Diane Waldman, who's mm-hmm. the curator of the Guggenheim Museum. He threatened to defenestrate me. Mm. I like that word. It's a very fancy word. And
it's not one of the seven words you can't say, so it's okay.
Yeah, it isn't. And I mean, I could give you the background story, but I don't think this is the time, place to do it.
No, we're talking about something wonderful, bread.
Yeah, bread. And, I just didn't, when I received the letter from the dean saying that I wasn't serious enough as a student there, I was like, okay. Sure.
But you cite Rome as an inspiration. Had you worked in a bakery in Italy?
No, I think, there's a period in our life, I'd say somewhere between, from when we're born until our mid-20s, where before we become in any way, shape, or form accustomed to or jaded, not to say that later in life we can't find experiences to change us or mold us or influence us, people, et cetera. And I had gone to Italy with a group of students while I was at Stony Brook as part of my language requirement. And when I got there, I think I was just in the right mode of right frame of mind to kind of absorb the social culture of food. And just ingredients themselves. I mean, I'd never eaten a tomato that in and of itself was enjoyable up until then. I'd only had these sort of what was the standard American hothouse tomato that were sent in those three packs. Hmm.
You could have found good tomatoes here as well, but you...
Yeah, I probably could have.
But they don't sell the three packs in Italy.
They don't sell the three packs. And also, I mean, there are also, it's interesting if you look at the history of regulation and law as it relates to the economic well-being of states and states lobbying for, you know, like an exclusive to produce certain food types. That's all kind of unraveling. But Florida, for quite some time, had kind of an exclusive on this type of tomato, which kind of became this sort of like a commodity in and of itself. And it was to such an extent that even in Florida, you couldn't grow on any scalable size commercially any other tomato other than the type, that hothouse tomato, that kind of insipid, bland, mealy, pink. Yeah, but you know, then you also have to look at, like, you know, I kind of like reverse engineering. I remember looking at a Craig Claiborne article, recipe. There was a recipe redux that Amanda Hessler had done on a 1967 or 69 article that Craig had written on how to make gazpacho, real Spanish gazpacho, and it was horrible. If you followed the original recipe, it was, and you realize that they weren't working with good tomatoes. They had to use what tomatoes were available, which were, I mean, you would know better than I because you have a longer memory than I do regarding what was
on. You're pointing out that I'm a lot older than you.
Yes, I am. I'm finding a very polite way of doing it. But, you know, and you know, you kind of realize, it makes you reflect, boy, have things have changed. I mean, the internet has made our society into this food conscious. There's a sort of a voracious desire to know how to make cheese, know how to make bread, sourdough cultures, fermented vegetables, you know, proper beard trimming techniques, everything, you know. I mean, it's
all things that we discuss on the show, by
exactly,
the way.
Exactly, yeah. So that was my experience when I was with this group of students in 1987, I think.
Okay, so 7 years later, or do you say 5 years later, you wind up in the bakery business. This is a complicated business.
Well, when I came back to New York, I wanted to bake. I wanted bread like I had in Italy, and I couldn't find any. And so I started baking bread at home. That's kind of where it all
started. Now, do you think if you'd gone to France, you'd had a very different life?
No, I think the same thing would have occurred. It just would have involved heavy cream and
different breads.
Yeah, and foie gras, probably.
Well, I've read that you opened Sullivan Street Bakery with little more than wild yeast that you had hand-cultivated in Italy and just a desire to bring the craft of small batch baking to America. Yeast, you actually were making your own wild yeast?
Well, I caught a culture using my own kind of, you know, intuition, naivete. You know, I knew that the bloom that was on cabbage leaves was a cocktail of different microbes, but of those microbes on there were Saccharomyces and also probably the bacteria that go along with it. And so I just mixed together some flour. I was living in Tuscany at the time, and in San Gimignano, and I just, from the garden that I was where I was staying, I just took a couple leaves of Lacinto kale, dinosaur kale, and I washed them off in water, and then I put a bunch of flour in it, and then I put it in a jar and threw it in a wine cellar, basically like the cantina for the house. It was an old farmhouse. And then it was raining cats and dogs for like weeks. I was there for like 2 weeks. And at some point it began to ferment, and I was like, smells like alcohol. I think we got it. And I can't say definitively if it was the lifting of the culture from the kale or just something that happened spontaneously. It could have been either or, but...
Because yeast is all around us, isn't it?
Yeast is everywhere. And
we're, you know, breathing yeast right now.
We're breathing it in. It's on our skin. I mean, if you're a germaphobe, you're in trouble because it's everywhere. I ended up, you know, but I have used this method with much success where you lift a culture off of some greens, a frond of an iris or a fennel, is like coated.
And you use fennel in a number of things.
Yeah.
But people make fun of kale eaters, and now it turns out that kale provides something very basic because everybody eats bread.
Well, again, this going back to the voraciousness of our society, thinking we can eat our way to health and well-being. You know, our problems. A bowl of kale will make our problems go away, and you could even use that to help promote or sell your multi-chained kale-based salad bar concept, which there are gazillions at this point.
And you have restaurants, so
I had a restaurant, a pizza joint, and you know this.
You closed it in February, even though it was really popular.
It was really popular, but you know you have to make a lot of pizza. I would like to reopen it one day, in the not too distant future. But I want to rethink it, rebuild it. I just kind of feel like, you know, you have to make a lot of pizza in order to make a profit. And I was trying to sing opera in terms of the way that we were approaching pizza making.
Called artisanal pizza.
Artisanal, yeah, but people want to listen to hip-hop now. They don't want to listen. They don't want to listen to opera. And so to a certain degree, I wasn't really, I was very happy with the restaurant and what we were making, and I was very happy till the day we closed. But I have no regrets closing.
You didn't sell pepperoni pizza.
We made a version of pepperoni pizza, which is in actually my third book, My Pizza, which, although it might not be a best-selling book, I think...
I'm sorry I left
no,
it
no, it's, oh, no, it's totally cool. I'm not offended. I'm not at all. But it's... I think there's a recipe in there for making a pepper sauce, which is awesome, using peeled red pepper meat, dried like dried Mexican peppers, and making almost like a kind of a piperada mole type thing. But it's all raw except for the dry pepper, with some nampla, some fish sauce in it, or dried anchovies, and as a replacement for tomato sauce, it's the, can I curse on your show? No, okay. It's okay. It's delicious.
I'm speaking with Jim Leahy, who among other things, has the Sullivan Street Bakery, which started on Sullivan Street in Soho, but you've retained the name even though you're now in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, I'm postmodern. I'm in that state. I'm also in Miami too. Mm-hmm. We opened up about a year ago. A little over a year in a neighborhood called Little Haiti.
So you're making Italian breads in Little Haiti?
We're making Italian breads in Little Haiti, or as it was called before it was called Little Haiti. The name of the neighborhood used to be Lemon City. So I like, you know, at one point it was all lemon groves, which is hard to believe. And then it became, I guess, middle class housing. And then I guess there was migrations of folks leaving and coming. And now
it's called White Flight.
It's called White Flight. And now it's has been a Haitian neighborhood for quite some time. I think about 20, 30 years, but now it's beginning to gentrify. So,
this is WBAI New York 99.5. I'm Leonard Lopate. The show is called Leonard Lopate at Large. So let's talk about the no-knead bread that so many people associate with you, that brought you to a prominence way beyond just simply having a bakery that people loved. Were you making no-knead breads from the start? Where did the idea come from? Did they make no-knead breads in Italy?
Well, the idea came from a series of experiences. When I was living in Tuscany, my friend Renato had said that, he said to me, you don't need to knead the dough. You know, he said, you don't need to knead the dough. You just can mix flour and water together and, you know, it will become dough eventually. I kind of stored that in the back of my brain somewhere. And then when I went to Florida, I had partnered with restaurateur Joe Allen. And Joe had been talking with a very well-regarded bakery named Michael London who owns a bakery up in Sarasota named Mrs. London's. It was called Rock Hill Bakery at the time. And he was traveling all around the world, U.S., doing setting up bakeries, and Joe was going to hire him. And I ended up knocking on his door at 1992 looking for a job, and rather than hiring the consultant, he decided to give me a try and ended up sending me down to Florida because he wanted to open up a bakery there. At that time, I guess the municipality hadn't treated the water, so it had all these, I think it's a magnesium sulfate, a sulfate of magnesium, in very elevated quantities in the tap water.
Is that bad for your health?
No, it's not at all. It's just like hard water, if you will. And what I noticed when I went down there, because I was going to initially in 1992 open a bakery in Miami, not New York. Miami was the original idea for Sullivan Street, coincidentally.
Too bad there's no place called street called Sullivan Street in Miami.
There must be a Sullivan Street. There must be. So I ended up going down there and trying to make bread, and it was an absolute disaster because every time I tried to knead it, either with a machine or by hand, at that point I was a hand kneader. I had mastered making doughs that were like almost one-to-one flour to water, like soupy, big mess. But every time I tried to knead the dough, it would just fall apart, and I couldn't figure out why. I didn't get the water tested until several years later, and then I went looking at some reference books. I saw that the presence of this sulfate has a catalyzing effect on the production of foil groups. You know, like the smell that they put into gas. So you smell gas. It smells kind of like onions, a little stinky. This thing in the water, magnesium sulfate, kind of acts as a catalyst to produce foils, which in turn, and some food chemists can correct us later on vis-a-vis an email, causes an overproduction of alpha amylase in the flour and also if you add yeast in the yeast, which in turn almost immediately causes the dough to fall apart. It doesn't stick together anymore. It just kind of becomes soup. So people used to say, and you remember this, you can't get a good bagel or a piece of pizza in Miami. It sucks. The water.
It's New York water that makes the best pizzas and bagels and bialys.
Well, that's a myth because, you know, also our water back then had a pH of 6.9. Today, it's 7.4. And the same is true for Florida. So I would hypothesize, because it's not like there are public meetings to talk about these changes that take place in municipalities. Oh, we're going to treat the water and make it safer for you. I would hypothesize that it's possible that municipalities are making decisions that affect our health and well-being, i.e. changing the water, which in turn could cause leaching of heavy metals or toxins that have been there or in the pipe systems for a long time that never made it into our drinking water. Just a hypothesis, you know, talking about Flint, you know. So anyway, our water is 7.4. Their water is 7.4. You can knead bread in Miami just like you knead bread in New York right now. There is no...
So they fixed the Miami water.
Well, we've made our water less acidic. So no more blue stains in the... if you have copper pipes or something in your sink or tub.
But I wonder why traditionally there are exceptions throughout history, but why traditionally bread was seen as something that you had to knead.
We only know what we know when we're born.
We've been making bread, it seems, for something like at least since 3000 BC.
No more, because they found recently in Lebanon or Jordan, they found a Neolithic site where they found flatbreads 17,000 years old.
Oh my.
So now there's this bread making was believed to be up to 10,000 BC. So now there's an even longer period
I wonder what kind of flour they were using.
They were using an antecedent to wheat, like an emmer or a spelt, and also mixing it with roots and tubers. So these ancient people were kind of making a paste, and they were making almost like an atandoor.
So it's like pita or something.
Like a pita bread, like a flatbread, like the breads you would see throughout Central Asia, all those breads that are slapped to the side.
And that would have been the goal, I imagine, during the story, the Passover story, that it didn't rise even that much, and that's how matzah was born, at least in the story.
I was thinking that, I believe there's a book written by a gentleman named H. E. Jacobs. It's called 6,000 Years of Bread, The Holy and Unholy History of Bread. It's a really fun book because, it has, from history onward, incredible scholarship to, he was the first person to write a book on the history of bread ever. There have been other books since then, but what's interesting is that he had to hypothesize prehistory, like how human beings figured out how to separate certain types of grasses and creates this whole fiction of ancient humans and how we studied ants, for example, and observed that around ant mounds in Africa. He claims that wheat and its forebears started in what is now Ethiopia, because Ethiopia is a gen center for ancient wheat varieties. It's like one of these areas where wheat started. But the history of wheat is really more Central Asia, Mesopotamia, Central Asia, areas that are now Turkmenistan, for example, which I had the incredible fortune of visiting. It's like a society not dissimilar from North Korea. Very few Americans get to visit. But I ended up going there and seeing this deep culture for bread.
Well, have you used any of those flours? Because people who are really serious about making some Italian breads will go to Italian specialty shops and bring in and only buy imported Italian flours.
Well, it's interesting.
The double O's.
The double O is just a designation for the fineness of the powder, if you will, the grind. I ended up visiting a friend of mine in Sicily who his name is Filippo Drago. Molino del Ponte is the name of his mill in Castelvetrano, Italy, southern coast. And he mills and works with farmers to grow organic ancient grains, meaning wheats that were grown when the Greeks were there, that farmers out of habit have continued to grow because these are the grains that the soil has nurtured and humans have lived off of. They don't work, they've got incredible flavor, but they don't work quite the same as the hard wheats that we're accustomed to eating, the white flour that we all know and love, which has as its origin kind of Japanese genetics, because the Japanese were the first to develop what short club wheat, as we know and love today. And, when we go to the supermarket and we buy flour, there'll be someone to correct me if I'm wrong, but looking at the scale of the industry and how big the bread or flour wheat industry, the commodity of wheat is globally, I would say there's no more than 5 strains of wheat that make up 95 plus, if not more, 98% of what we consume globally. It's like all the same type of wheat. It's a monoculture. We're all eating iceberg lettuce, for example. There are no other varieties of lettuce. And wheat, as if you've ever had a chance to interview Stephen Jones from University of Washington, Mount Vernon, is America's foremost breeder of wheats, if you will, ancient varieties. I believe there's over 4,700 varieties of wheats, gray, bluish, purplish, pink. all these different colors.
I mean, naturally, those colors.
Naturally. The grain has carotenoids that have this color. But you know, the whole concept of white flour or clean flour was a something for people of dignity and class. In fact, I've interviewed a lot of Italian people who were alive during the Second World War, and they have said to me that, you know, before the Second World War, they always ate pane nero, black bread, pane nero, the local grains that were grown. They had, like, they were dark, they were brown, they were, you know, they weren't whole wheat, they were still cleaned. They still had the bran and the germ and a lot of the components that make up whole wheat out. So, like, they were what they call extracted. But the wheat itself had color. And then after the Second World War, when the Americans, we came in and we had to feed all the Italians, we brought all wheat strains and then white bread. And then it was just like, kind of like, almost like avoidance of the older flours.
It almost sounds racist that white flour seems preferable to
black
flour.
Well, it's not. It was really, I think it was more about the idea of it being cleaned. It was about the idea that, you know, in terms of being able to eat it, in terms of its its ability to trap gas or form uninterrupted cross-link networking, which is what happens when the proteins absorb water, swell up, and unravel, and then they kind of form like a fabric with the starch, which in turn can trap the air, trap the gases that are being produced. Whereas when there's wheat bran or fiber, the fiber actually punctures all those alveoli, the little bubbles in the dough.
So if you want to be a serious baker, you also have to be a chemist.
Well, you're talking like a chemist.
I mean,
this is because I read this stuff. I mean, but I didn't. I made fine bread without knowing any of this. Having baking skill or intuition is really just about, you know, it's like that. You got to know when to fold it, know when to roll it, know when to walk away, know when to. Never count your baguettes when you're sitting at the table. Sorry. I was trying to make a Kenny Rogers
reference.
Those Kenny Rogers jokes really go over my head. Yeah, and actually I know that no one in the audience understands what I'm saying. So, but, you know, I don't think you really have to know. You have to love the work first. You don't need to know about musical theory and about composition. You just have to, like, feel a joy in doing the music, singing, putting your fingers on the keys of a piano. It doesn't mean you're going to become a great pianist, guitarist, whatever, or baker, but it all proceeds from this passion, this love. And I found this passion and love. And then, of course, the passion and love for the making of the bread brought me to this desire to understand why.
I'm speaking with Jim Leahy on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Jim is the man behind Sullivan Street Bakery and also three books, one called My Bread, the other the Sullivan Street Bakery Cookbook, and the third one on pizza. Jim Leahy of Sullivan Street Bakery. I asked you a question before. We never really got the answer.
What was the question?
The question was, how did you wind up coming? How did you come up with your recipe for no-knead bread?
So I'm in Florida, and I'm trying to make a loaf of bread, and I'm failing miserably. And I noticed one thing was that the moment that I mix the flour and the water together, the dough is beautiful. But literally, the second flour and water united, it was perfect. And then as I kept going, the more I went, the worse it became. So I stopped myself, and, you know, my memory was what Renato told me, my friend told me. And I just kind of did that. I just mixed the flour and water together and stopped the moment that the flour and water were united, but didn't develop it in any way, shape, or
form. But the idea of kneading it was that you wanted to incorporate everything. Self-incorporating?
Well, kneading it means kind of trying to mechanically align the proteins, trying to mechanically get things to kind of align. And another thing that made me think about this was that, you know, I've gone to lots of different bakeries in Italy, in lots of different little towns.
Do they do no-knead breads there?
Kind of, without realizing it. Like in some of the places, the water is extremely hard because someone's using well water. So they don't really develop the dough. They don't really need it that much. And it makes sense because the water is like the water in Florida. It's like coming from limestone. It's just got all this mineral, all these different minerals and sulfates and as a result, I kind of intuited, I was asked by Cesare Casella, a friend of mine who's a chef, who was doing a cookbook based on Apicius, the first cookbook writer in human history.
Where we get Epicurean from?
I don't think Apicius is where you get Epicurean.
Okay.
But he
I was,
was
just guessing.
But maybe. Because I thought Epicurus was Greek. Wasn't he Greek?
He was
a philosopher. But, so he asked me to make bread like they would have made during ancient Rome. And so, I looked at images and books of breads from Pompeii that are like kind of set up as like a stamped so you can break them apart. So I kind of went for that form. But then I thought, there would have been mass rebellion and the Romans would have never conquered the entire world if the process of making the bread itself was in any way, shape, or form difficult. It had to be easy because the hard work was sowing, cultivating, harvesting, tying up the bundles of wheat to dry, curing it, and then the most difficult part, winnowing it, beating it, so that you can separate the chaff from the berry. And I thought, after all that work, 17 to 20 people per acre of land, let's say in antiquity, then they would need like another 20 people to make the bread because they have to like knead it. No way. And then I just kind of like put together in my memory, I ended up thinking about all the different bakeries I visited that were like the bakery, like in houses, for example, like an old farmhouse where they have an oven outside the house or part of the house and the house is 500 years old. They weren't kneading the dough. They were just kind of kneading meant incorporating flour and water together, and then they would theoretically fold the dough to develop some strength or texture depending on how the flour was, because some flour can't take that stress and actually will, if the protein, the gluten, is of poorer quality, not quantity. You can have the highest quantity protein imaginable, but if the protein quality is poor, it won't be able to ferment and trap gas.
Now, I looked up no-knead bread in Wikipedia, and it cites examples going back to the 1970s. You point out that it's probably been with us forever.
Well,
recipe you came up with that Mark Bittman videotape. Why do you think that just took off as though it was a revelation?
Well, because of the end result that people got, and they had the aha moment, and because of the small quantity of yeast or ferment that was in it, and that flavor development that you unlock through fermentation, whereas there was some lady named Dunaway who produced a book called No Need to Knead. But she's ripping off Ida Pillsbury No Need book that she wrote in the 40s, which is like, it's really more of a way of selling yeast. You put tons of yeast in, you don't need it, and it leavens, because it will leaven. But I mean, Pillsbury did this as well. I mean, she's the first person to make a book using the word no knead, and Mark Bittman, and at the dawn of the internet and what is like the world of viral. I kind of feel like I have more to do with starting food blogs
because
than anything
because
everyone
because
in the
they
world,
videotaped the process and
yeah,
that
yeah, well,
really allowed people to understand it in a way that they couldn't if they were just reading it on a page.
But if you look at the timeline between no knead bread and the dawn of food bloggers, there's a correlation between my recipe and the launch of like this mania where everyone ends up launching these, and you know, off of the first or second recipe for their food blog was this discovery of this bread that they made.
So let's get back to chemistry, even though you're not a chemist. You mentioned gluten. What role does gluten play in the bread-making process, and what happens with all those people who claim they're gluten-free?
Gluten is a unique protein that is sticky, elastic. It's viscoelastic. And has the unique ability to kind of capture and trap gas. You don't eat just gluten. Gluten is a minor component in flour. It might be anywhere from 9%, 8% to 14% of the total weight of the flour. But the mixture of the flour and the starch together, these little particles of starch with protein, create a fabric, if you will, when after you've united it with water, that can trap gas like bubble gum does, like a chewing gum would, in a way. Actually, it's kind of ironically, because you know, chewing gum is filled with our breath, and our breath is carbon dioxide, and you know, yeasts, when they metabolize the starch in flour, basically just their waste product is carbon dioxide and alcohol.
Wow. So you can't make a gluten-free bread.
Well, you can't. No one has successfully made a fermented gluten-free product. And I don't know whether it would be that interesting. I mean, I do like Brazilian pão de queijo, the cheese bread. I mean, it's like if I wanted a gluten-free substitute, or pan de bono if you're from Ecuador or Colombia, but I would prefer that than these, which is just made from tapioca starch, water, oil, milk, and eggs. I would prefer that to these like mixtures that really you don't know what's in these mixtures. I mean, I hate to say it, I don't want to pop anyone's bubble, but you know, if you're gluten intolerant, try eating Brazilian pão de queijo with organic tapioca starch, or eat rice.
Now, your
I love rice.
Your cookbook,
rice cakes,
the Sullivan Street Bakery cookbook, includes home baking recipes for sourdough versions of the pugliese, the brioche, the multigrain breads that are really popular in your bakery, and they include step-by-step guides to making a sourdough starter. You can do the sourdough without kneading as well?
Yeah, all you do is add flour and water together, and the flour itself might be the inoculant, if you will. You're creating a substrate.
So then you just let it sit for a long time.
Yeah, you're creating a Petri dish, but instead of agar-agar, that pink alga that doctors use when they take a culture from your throat, your substrate, instead of agar-agar, is flour and water. And when you add something like a piece of a fruit that has like the skin of a fruit, or I recommend washing off like the bloom from a cabbage, because I've had success with this everywhere I've gone. I've never, even if I've gotten flour that's been...
So that's different, other than not using yeast then?
Not using yeast. Well, you create your own culture, which is renewable for the life of its...
People are going to be so angry with you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Speaking of which, you know, at one point I tried to monetize this way back in the beginning. This is kind of a cute anecdote, and I don't really care if Fleischmann is upset about this, but I ended up approaching, because I was just trying to figure out, like, you know, try to be a clever business person, but I'm not. I'm the antithesis of a clever business person. So I ended up reaching out to Fleischmann's, and I tried to see whether they would want me to endorse their yeast. And of course, I'm not trying to sell. I mean, you know, one little packet of yeast that you buy from the supermarket can last for, per my method, you can make 20 batches of bread from it, literally. So they weren't that interested in it. But then they ended up launching, along with a lot of other companies, like 8 years ago, nine years ago, all these no-knead mixes with their yeast already in it. And I was talking with their PR folk and stuff, it was really cute. I mean, it's just kind of like how corporate America works. Everyone is basically looking to.
Well, aren't you concerned that if people can make really great bread at home, that they won't come to your bakery?
No, well, one of the things is, I don't know. I mean, I think the goal is if people start making really good bread at home, it's going to force us bakers to up our game and make better bread in our bakeries. It's the standards in people's homes that creates like a culture for something. We don't have in this country a culture for wheat like we do for cannabis or for wine, or coffee even, because, wheat doesn't, it just nourishes you. It doesn't get you high, and the flavor differences between one strain of yeast and another are subtle. And, there are people, there's a baker in Washington, D.C., who I admire immensely. I think he's probably one of the best bakers in the country. His name is Jonathan Bethany, and he has a lovely bakery, mill and bakery. He does the real deal. He mills it and bakes it. He even makes his own malt from sprouting grain.
So he has to get the wheat from somebody.
He sources the grains regionally or somewhere in the U.S. I don't even know. I haven't been to his bakery since he opened. I just remember chatting with him before he opened his bakery up, and I've sampled his breads, and they're just phenomenally delicious, But he sources his grains from regionally, I believe, and then he sprouts it, which means like you soak the grains, you begin to wait until they form a little tail, and then you dry them out, and then after you dry them, you toast them, and then you ground it down or make a tea and cook it down until you have like a syrup.
Was the no-knead approach part of also part of your book that you called My Pizza, the easy, no-knead way to make spectacular pizza at home?
Because
when I go to my local pizzeria, they are still kneading the dough that's going to wind up being the crust.
Yeah, pizza being the food genre that it is, the ancient food genre that it is, it's kind of like there's a culture for pizza. There's a culture for bread too. I mean, most of the bread that's sold is industrially produced.
They use machines to mix them.
Everything. I mean, industrial baking is the lion's share of all bread consumed, just like the monocultures, the couple strains of wheat that we find in our supermarket. All those different brands of wheat are kind of meaningless because they're not dealing with a single variety of wheat. Just like nobody, and this is one of the things that has pissed me off for over 20 years, pissed me off. Can I say that? I can say that. Made me angry. Thank you. Is the presence of glyphosate, which is known as Roundup, which is a cancer-causing chemical.
It's in all of our corn as well.
It's in all of our Cheerios. It's in all of our cereals that our children are consuming, organic and not, because I don't think – I mean, unless on a box it says glyphosate-free. And I know that our Senator Schumer is trying to – forced the current administration's FDA to release the report that shows that there is glyphosate in all the foods that are in our supermarkets, but for whatever reason, it's not happening. But the more people that get out there and demand it, the better. I use, per that discussion on glyphosate, I use winter wheat only because winter wheat is much less likely to be sprayed with glyphosate. Whereas most all spring wheat, which is what most people consume in of those monocultures, because that's the bulk of most of the flour that's produced, is sprayed with glyphosate to improve or enhance the yield of the crops that are there, the value, if you will.
Jim Leahy is my guest on Leonard Lopate at Large today on WBAI 99.5 FM. You also are raising pigs upstage?
No, I had...
You
I,
did that? Were you giving them feed that had glyphosate?
No. We just had my neighbors and I. My neighbors are farmer family, and they would get like 5 or 6 pigs, and I would buy a couple from them when I had the restaurant. Just because it's really nice to know the animal that you're eating if you're going to eat any meat, and it really is so much better than what we would buy from a butcher. I mean, let's say it's kind of interesting to understand it in that way, and it kind of made me respect that if we're going to eat meat, to be a little bit more respectful of what we eat.
Did some of the dishes that you give recipes for in your cookbooks, like apple fennel pizza, cardamom cinnamon buns, hamburger buns, brisket braised in black tea, orange olive oil cake, chicken fritter and tahini sandwich, Italian cookies, cornetti and crostatas, you also have a panettone. They are the things that you were making for the restaurant and for the for your bakery?
Well, the bakery is 24 years old. We'll be 25 this June, next June, upcoming June. So
West Side in the 40s.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's anecdotal. I would just come up with something for fun that we would run for a while. Some of the things stuck. Some of it were from all the wonderful people that we have had working at the bakery, that recipes that I just liked. So it was kind of like a very slim cross section of a lot of the things that we had made over the 25 years, and some of the things that we're currently making. Like I have a really great recipe for pasta frolla, which we make in the bakery. Like crostata and stuff like that.
So you can make pasta making is similar to bread baking?
Well, no, pasta, using no, flour? No, pasta just means paste in Italian, right. But pasta frolla is like a pastry dough. Uh-huh. Like a pate, like a brise or a, like a, it's like a cookie. It's actually like a universal cookie dough.
And you also play drums just for the sheer enjoyment of getting out some of the energy that... you're building up, doing all this other stuff?
I like, it's a release for me. I like to just, either try some new time signatures or just some exercises or, put an album on and jam out, mm-hmm. If I have a friend come over, I'll play some music with them. But in general,
One of the things I really appreciate in your books is also your suggestions for how to use things that may have failed in other recipes.
Yeah.
Although the no-knead bread, you say, never really fails, even if it doesn't look the way you fantasized it was going to.
Yeah, well, we have control over...
But every kitchens in different parts of the country, as you pointed out with the water, are going to vary. Ovens vary. The air varies just when it's muggy, whether you have the air conditioner on, whether it's the temperature's hot or cold. Well, so how much do humidity, we be aware of all of that?
Well, humidity will affect fermentation in that it's more favorable for fermentation, and as a result of it being like temperature, for example, temperature and humidity. But it won't necessarily change in any discernible way the actual absorption, especially on the scale that we're making these recipes, this tiny scale, these little batches of bread. It won't change the amount of flour that the water that the flour absorbs. That being said, obviously, if it's really humid out, a powder like wheat flour might absorb a little bit more. It might be more than 14%, because typically wheat is about 12.5 to 14% humidity.
Do you care whether the flour is one of the big commercial ones like Pillsbury, or would you prefer King Arthur, or there some of the ones?
Well, King Arthur is like, I think they're a great brand, but they don't mill their flour. They just have other people mill it for them. So, their flour is milled where, like Little Caesars Pizza Company's flour is milled, or other brands get milled. They just contract it out, but they've somehow convinced a huge number of people in this
country. Me.
Yeah, that they're like a legitimate flour mill. And at one point they were, but I think the regional mill, and I've been trying to encourage my mill, I buy my mill flour from the same company that mills for King Arthur. It's called Bay State Milling. And it's a smaller, it's relatively smaller than, I think it's called Horizon Mills, I think is the largest right now.
But you can't get these things in the supermarket.
Well, I've been trying to convince them that they should be their own, be your own brand. You know, just go out and I'm not saying monetize. I'll market your flour for you. Stamp it glyphosate free. See whether people want to buy it.
There are some companies that do sell their stuff through the internet, but that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, King Arthur is a great example of that. And they're a really cool company. They're committed to, trying to promote bread baking and cake making and all this other stuff. And they've got, like, a school, an online shop. They teach all sorts of classes and stuff. And that's really cool. You know, I mean, anything that to promote food knowledge is good.
It's been so much fun talking with you, Jim Leahy.
Likewise, Leonard. It's been too long.
And you running off now to
pick up the kids?
Store?
Picking up the kids from school.
Wow.
Gotta jet downtown.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Jim Leahy, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls. Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robinhood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.